Good evening. Before I begin talking about Ayn Rand, let me take a little poll here. How many of you have read something that she has written or she wrote? Oh, we have quite a number of hands. Well, for the rest of you, I will give a little background, a little explanation of who this person is. Ayn, it's an unusual name, A-Y-N, and her last name is Rand. Many people know her through her novels. The most famous are The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. The Fountainhead was made into a movie about 40 years ago now, and Atlas Shrugged, you hear rumors from time to time that it's being made into a movie, but none has appeared as yet. Ayn Rand died in 1982, and before she died, there were rumors that she was working on the screenplay for a movie version of her major novel called Atlas Shrugged. What makes her interesting and important, among other things, is she was one of the few philosophers of either the 19th or the 20th centuries who attempted to offer a complete worldview, a complete philosophy from A to Z. In her case, A stood for altruism, art, abstraction, and atheism, and Z stood for zero, and she writes about the zeros in some of her books. In a dozen books, she discussed the sub-disciplines of aesthetics, the theory of art, theory of beauty, ethics, metaphysics, politics, epistemology, and economics. She fiercely resisted the fragmentation of philosophy. In the modern era, she was scornful of those philosophers, for example, who discussed nothing but language. She believed that the purpose of philosophy was to guide the lives of men. For Rand, philosophy was not merely an academic game, as it has become for many academicians, but it's a matter, literally, of life and death. The force and the purpose of her novels, especially Atlas Shrugged, was to show that choosing the wrong philosophy would result in one's own death and the deaths of the societies in which you happen to live. Choosing the correct philosophy, she argued, will avert that death, at least for a while. Now, none of this can Rand's views be faulted. In fact, one of her many of her specific positions were such that you cannot oppose them, or ought not oppose them. She, for example, opposed a woman being president of the United States, and published an article in the Ladies' Home Journal to that effect. They were soliciting the views of famous women, and by mistake, they asked her for her view. And she wrote an essay, not a long one, but a short essay, explaining why a woman should never be president of the United States. She was opposed to homosexuality. In some ways, her views were what you might call traditional. She was very opposed to homosexuality. She had no philosophical reason for being opposed to homosexuality, but she did oppose it. She regarded it as, if not a sin, at least immoral behavior. She advocated private property. She advocated hard work, the work ethic. She was an advocate of capitalism or free enterprise. She was an advocate of limited government. She asserted that logic is indispensable in both theoretical and practical matters. In fact, her novel Atlas Shrugged is divided into three major sections named after the three basic laws of logic. While a Christian might agree with some of these things, even many of her sentences in her books He will find it harder to agree with her paragraphs, impossible almost to agree with many of her pages, and impossible certainly to agree with any of her books. Once Rand wrote out her arguments for some of her views, rather than merely staking out specific positions, her philosophy disintegrated. Of course, many of her positions in themselves are incompatible with Christianity. Rand was an empiricist. She believed in the myth of the blank mind on which the senses project their images of the real world. She believed in the consistency and the reliability of the senses. She was an atheist and a militant atheist, despite the efforts of some of her philosophers to say that atheism was a minor part of her philosophy. In fact, Rand, who was born in Russia and educated under the communists, adopted the metaphysics and epistemology of the communists as her own. She reacted against the communists, whom she loathed, only in their economics and politics. She thought she could construct a rational philosophy on the same foundation on which the communists constructed their form of what she called muscle mysticism. Rather than trying to refute all of Rand's philosophy in this hour, I intend to focus only on one aspect of it, and that's her political philosophy, thinking perhaps that might be of the most interest to this audience. In this way, I want to illustrate how Christian apologetics may be done. As I criticize her philosophy, please notice how the argument proceeds. We begin not necessarily with a statement of Scripture, although that would not be out of place, but with a statement from Rand, just as Jesus and Paul did in their apologetics. And we saw last night several examples of how Jesus and Paul would take statements from their opponents and draw out inferences from those statements to embarrass their opponents. Paul does it at great length in 1 Corinthians 15. We will begin, for the most part, with statements from Rand, and then we will attempt to do several things with those statements. And I could break them down, but I'll summarize them here by simply saying we will show either that these statements contradict other statements that Rand has made, or their implications contradict other statements that Rand has made, convicting her of self-contradiction. And if she contradicts herself, then at least part of her philosophy is false. Or we will show that her statements contradict known truths, that is, biblical propositions. The method is to show that Rand contradicts herself and thus refutes herself, or contradicts Scripture and thus shows herself to be false. This is the same method that Jesus and Paul used in reasoning with their opponents. It's the only method that Christians are entitled to use in apologetics. Rand herself asserted, seeing philosophy as an entire system, that her political philosophy rested on her ethical philosophy, which in turn rested on her metaphysical philosophy, which in turn rested on her epistemology. So even if we could find no fault in her political philosophy, it might still be indefensible. So you have a structure in her thinking that begins with a theory of knowledge or epistemology, on which you build a theory of reality, just above it, one story above it. On those two, you build a theory of ethics, theory of conduct, on the third story, and above that, you have your theory of politics or political philosophy. Now, if the foundation, epistemology, is bad, the whole structure collapses. But I don't intend to talk about her epistemology tonight. I intend to talk only about her political philosophy. If any link to to change the metaphor, if any link in the long chains of arguments that she presents is broken, then the whole system collapses. This is one of the dangers of asserting a systematic philosophy. You have to make sure that all the parts make sense. But if any link is broken, then the whole thing is worthless. I will refer you to my book, Without a Prayer, for the arguments concerning Rand's epistemology, her metaphysics, and her ethics, and focus entirely on her political views. Let me also say that if you haven't read any of Rand's books, you probably should do so. For our purposes today, the relevant books would be Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal, and The New Left, The Anti-Industrial Revolution. That's Capitalism and The New Left. Nearly every major bookstore chain carries them. You can go to, I'm sure, bookstores in Rowlett and find books by Ayn Rand. Rand's books, her novels in particular, continue to sell very well without any advertising. Or keep in mind that Rand has been dead for 16 years. Her books are not advertised, yet they continue to sell in the neighborhood of 200,000 to 300,000 copies a year by word of mouth. A few years ago, the Book of the Month Club conducted a poll of its members to determine which books had had the most influence on their lives. The most influential book, the Book of the Month Club members listed, was the Bible. The second most influential was Atlas Shrugged. So in considering Rand's philosophy, we're not wasting our time on some unknown or uninfluential thinker. She appeals particularly to young people, to high school, senior high school students, and college students. She has a particular audience among them. I read one review recently in a Lutheran publication of my book, and the reviewer began by saying, everyone goes through an Ayn Rand phase in college. Some of us get over it. John Robbins hasn't. And the reviewer ended by saying, well, I guess by writing this review, neither have I. The two essays that Rand's ethical theory is based or expressed in and ties itself to her political theory are entitled Man's Rights and the Nature of Government. And she's going to express some ideas that may sound familiar to you, because she thought that she was expressing Jeffersonian ideas. She says in these essays, especially in Man's Rights, if one wishes to advocate a free society, and she did, one must realize that its indispensable foundation is the principle of individual rights. Rights are a moral concept, she said, the concept that provides a logical transition from the principles guiding an individual's actions to the principles guiding his relationship with others. The link between the moral code of a man and the legal code of a society, between ethics and politics. Individual rights are the means of subordinating society to moral law. The concept of individual rights, of natural rights, is central to her political philosophy. And if her concept of natural rights stands, then her politics stands. If it falls, her politics falls also. Before proceeding with her argument, Rand launched an attack on, quote, variants of the altruist collectivist doctrine which subordinated the individual to some higher authority. Under all such systems, morality was a code applicable to the individual, but not to society. Society was placed outside the moral law. Rand regarded Christianity as a variant of the altruist collectivist doctrine, and thus implied that Christian moral law, the Ten Commandments, does not apply to society. Leaving aside this false categorization of Christianity, it simply is not true that Christianity places society outside the moral law. Christian philosophers and theologians have written about the moral law, asserting that the commandments apply to all men, both as individuals and as institutions, corporations, and rulers. Governments, that is, governors, as well as private individuals, can lie, covet, steal, murder, blaspheme, profane the Sabbath, and become idolatrous, and they have done so with great frequency throughout history. Governments as institutions cannot commit adultery or dishonor their parents, but governors have and continue to do so. The Bible is quite clear not only in reporting how governors have violated the moral law that applies to them, but in asserting that all governors will be held accountable by God for their violations of His commandments and will be punished for those violations. So her first mistake here is saying that Christianity somehow placed society above or outside the moral law. The Bible does not. Now, unfortunately, Rand's impression of the Bible, of Christianity, was probably derived less from the Bible and more from what she heard from contemporary theologians. And it's a very common view in churches today to hear that whatever the government decides to do is merely a matter of prudence. The government is not subject to the moral law in the same sense that we are. Because the government is a minister of God, then the government has the right to do X things that if individuals did, would be violations of those laws. Well, Rand ignored the differences between Christianity and other religions and philosophies in her efforts to establish her philosophy as unique. In fact, had she been better acquainted with English and American history, she would have known that subjecting governors and governments to moral law was accomplished by Christians applying Christian ideas to politics. It was Christian moral law to which government was subjected. Because of her humanist bias, Rand ignored the testimony of American history. Nevertheless, she alone cannot be faulted. An acquaintance of mine calls me from Canada from time to time to lament the state of the church he attends, and I fear that it's typical of many churches. If his descriptions are accurate, Canadian churchgoers believe that government is indeed outside or above the moral law, and that whatever governments decide to do, simply because they are governments, is legitimate. That view, of course, is not a Christian view, yet it is a typical view of many churches. Rand returned to her argument about natural rights by defining a right as, quote, a moral principle, defining and sanctioning a man's freedom of action in a social context. Rights, man gave us to understand, are not a gift to society, nor of God, but are innate or inherent. She said, the source of man's rights is not divine law or congressional law, but the law of identity. A is A, and man is man. Rights as developed by Rand is an equivocal concept. Yet she proceeded to argue as though she had provided a logical justification for rights in order to conclude that government may use force only in retaliation and only against those who initiate its use. Rand informed us, basically, there is only one way to violate rights, by the use of physical force. She also told us that government may in fact use physical force as long as it is in retaliation and not initiation. As with her other central ideas, Rand offered no valid argument, indeed little argument at all, to justify this moral distinction between initiated force and retaliatory force. If Rand had been guided by logic, she would have been forced to conclude that retaliatory force is a violation of right. That is the requirement of logic, but not the conclusion of Rand. She preferred to differentiate, for some unspoken reason, between initiated and retaliatory force. Now, such a moral distinction between starting the use of force and simply responding to the use of force, between retaliation and initiation, may strike the reader or you folks as plausible. And that's what Rand is counting on. It relieved her of showing, on the basis of her own theory, how retaliatory force does not violate rights, while initiated force does. She followed this assertion by several paragraphs of rhetoric, apparently hoping that no reader would be perceptive enough to raise the important question. The essay concludes, Man's Rights, concludes without any argument offered for her moral distinction between initiated and retaliatory force. Rand appealed to the distinction between murder and self-defense, as a distinction her readers already accepted, to illustrate her distinction between initiated and retaliatory force. Unfortunately, she appealed to a distinction she was required to establish. That is, she assumed the principle that she was supposed to prove. If all men have the same rights at all time, as she wrote, then how are murder and self-defense to be distinguished? Her view of inalienable natural rights permits no moral distinction between murder and self-defense. A quote from Rand, since man has inalienable individual rights, this means that the same rights are held individually by every man, by all men, at all times. Let me read that again. Since inalienable individual rights are found not only in Rand, but in the Declaration of Independence, I'll read it again. Since man has inalienable individual rights, this means that the same rights are held individually by every man, by all men, at all times. If that is true, there can be no moral distinction between initiated and retaliatory force. In her essay, The Nature of Government, Rand dropped the cautious basically and asserted, man's rights can be violated only by the use of physical force. Notice the only by the use of physical force. This statement logically implies that blackmail, fraud, perjury, pollution, breach of contract, embezzlement, misprision of a felony, misrepresentation, conspiracy, child neglect, adultery, libel, slander, sodomy, and other actions correctly recognized as crimes, but which do not involve the initiation of force, are not violations of man's rights. Furthermore, Rand asserted that rights can be violated only by means of physical force, initiated physical force. But her next step in the argument was that all initiated physical force is therefore a violation of right. Unfortunately for her political theory, this is an elementary logical blunder, the fallacy of the converse. The proposition that all violation of rights is by initiated physical force does not imply that all initiated physical force is a violation of right. Any more than the statement that all dogs are canines implies that all canines are dogs, or that all Chinese are humans implies that all humans are Chinese. Her argument and her political theory, as well as the political theories of secular libertarians who have followed Rand on this point, depend on this elementary logical blunder. All P is Q does not logically imply that all Q is P. Rand then attempted to justify her earlier distinction between initiated and retaliatory force. This is what she wrote. The necessary consequence of man's right to life is his right to self-defense. In a civilized society, force may be used only in retaliation and only against those who initiate its use. All the reasons which make the initiation of physical force an evil make the retaliatory use of physical force a moral imperative. If, as Rand maintained, force may be properly used only in retaliation and only against those who initiate its use, all court proceedings and wars involve immorality. A free society could not morally defend itself against either criminals or international aggression. It is one of the characteristics of litigation and war that some innocent people are subjected to the use of force. In the quotation above, Rand erroneously equated retaliation with self-defense. This identification does not meet the objection that she failed to explain the moral distinction between initiated and retaliatory force on the basis of her theory, and it opens up further objections. Isn't self-defense a violation of someone's rights? If rights are innate and inalienable, how can a criminal lose his rights? Think about what the word inalienable means. If rights come from his identity as a man, is not a criminal still a man and therefore still a possessor of his rights? If rights are inalienable by nature, by the logical law of identity, how can they be alienated? And if a criminal cannot alienate his rights, how can it be maintained that the use of force against him is not a violation of his rights? Rand maintained, when we say that we hold individual rights to be inalienable, we must mean just that. Inalienable means that which we may not take away, suspend, infringe, restrict, or violate, not ever, not at any time, not for any purpose whatsoever. That statement precludes punishment, and therefore it precludes justice. Rand was vehemently opposed to taxation and the redistribution of wealth by government. But her argument in favor of taking government grants and scholarships contradicted that position. She wrote, "The recipient of a public scholarship is morally justified only so long as he regards it as restitution and opposes all forms of welfare statism. Those who advocate public scholarships have no right to them. Those who oppose public scholarships have. The victims do not, I'm not making this up. The victims do not have to add self-inflicted martyrdom to the injury done to them by others. They do not have to let the looters profit doubly by letting them distribute the money exclusively to the parasites. Whenever the welfare state laws offer them some small restitution, the victims should take it. The same moral principles and considerations apply to the issue of accepting Social Security, unemployment insurance, or other payments of that kind. It is obvious in such cases that a man receives his own money, which was taken from him by force." Not only does this argument, offered as advice to students, Social Security recipients, unemployment recipients, and anyone else receiving money from the government, contradict her libertarian strictures against legalized theft, it's patently invalid. It is not obvious, nor is it true, to challenge her last statement, that a person who accepts a government grant, whether it be a scholarship or Social Security, is merely getting his own money back. In fact, his money paid in taxes has already been spent. It is already gone. The government spends money faster than it collects in taxes. It redistributes wealth. Therefore, a person cannot get his own money back. Any money he receives is stolen from someone else. He cannot get even without injuring others. Furthermore, these welfare state programs are not offered as a means of restitution, as Rand said, but as a means of redistribution. Regarding them as restitution, as Rand advocated, is an excellent example of faking reality, to which Rand claimed to be opposed. It seems, however, that Rand believed one may and should fake reality if such faking results in getting a check from the government. Worse, notice that Rand wrote that those who are opposed to these programs have a right to them. What kind of right is this? A right to a welfare program only if you oppose welfare programs? Could Ellsworth Toohey himself have thought of, let alone advocated, anything so irrational? Rand, beginning as an advocate of limited government, private property, and justice, ended by advising her student readers, that was primarily her constituency and the reason why she wrote that essay, to grab whatever they can get from the government, so long as they also oppose welfare statism. Whatever monies they receive are merely restitution for the harm done to them and to their ancestors. Many, perhaps all, thieves convince themselves that what they are stealing is really theirs by right. The rich really owe the money to the poor, having first stolen it from them, right? The employers really owe the money to the underpaid workers, right? The bourgeoisie, through its exploitation of the working class, deserves to be expropriated. Don't many, perhaps most thieves, think they are only taking what they deserve? Rand's advocacy of legalized theft is no different in principle from the rationalization that common thieves and revolutionary communists have fabricated to justify their own violations of the Eighth Commandment. Rand's argument illustrates how easily rational ethics can be turned whichever way one wishes. If men have natural, inalienable rights, as Rand and Thomas Jefferson asserted, then all punishment is immoral, to return to something I've mentioned. It is immoral because punishment is a violation of inalienable rights. Execution is a violation of the inalienable right to life. Imprisonment is a violation of the inalienable right to liberty. Fines are violations of the inalienable right to property. It is no accident that the erosion of justice and the collapse of the criminal justice system in the U.S. has been fueled by demands for the recognition of the rights of criminals. What has occurred over the last 40 years is the outworking in practice of what the notion of inalienable rights implies in theory. The theory of natural rights logically requires that there be no punishment, for punishment is itself a crime, a violation of those rights. If rights are indeed inalienable, then nothing a person can do can make him lose those rights. There is a fundamental logical incompatibility between justice and inalienable rights, and for the past 40 years, justice has been vitiated by the doctrine of inalienable rights. Rand ignored the difference, as we've seen, between self-defense and retaliation and punishment, and treated them all as identical, and proceeded to argue that retaliatory force must be organized, objective, and monopolistic. Let's examine the last characteristic of government first. Rand believed that, quote, government holds a monopoly on the legal use of physical force. Such a bold assertion is simply and obviously untrue. Parents legally use physical force regularly. Moreover, unless they live in some socialist hive, they initiate it regularly in the discipline of their children. Secondly, in the United States at least, in theory and in practice at one time, no single government, local, state, or national, has a legal monopoly on the use of force. The genius of the federal system, and it's a system of government that Rand seems never to have understood, is to deny explicitly that any one government should have a legal monopoly on the use of force. The entire theory of both the division and separation of powers is a denial that there is any government or any part of government that has such a monopoly. The other two characteristics of a free society, according to Rand, are that the use of retaliatory force is organized. That is, it's in a government, and it's objective. That is, it's under law. Furthermore, the source of the government's authority, according to Rand, is the consent of the governed. This means that the government as such has no rights except the rights delegated to it by the citizens for a specific purpose. And this is good and standard American political theory. We are given to understand, then, that government and its just powers are entirely derivative. The consent of the governed creates and informs the institution of government. That's obviously good Lockean or Jeffersonian theory, but it's not necessarily true. John Locke and Thomas Jefferson had one or two false ideas. All governments, in one sense, a somewhat trivial sense, rest on the consent of the governed. The Austrian economist Ludwig von Mises expressed this by saying that in the long run, there's no such thing as an unpopular government. But this meaning of consent is obviously not that intended by Jefferson or Rand. For them, consent is the secular substitute for divine ordination. It is not a passive condition, but a creative moral action. Nor is popular consent merely the means of instituting a government, as it was, for example, in ancient Israel when the people consented to the constitution God had written for them. Popular consent, in Rand's theory, is the source of moral authority for government. It is to this notion of consent that we must direct our attention. Our first question must be, if government is merely the right of self-defense externalized, how can men delegate their inalienable rights to government? Natural rights are by definition inalienable. And if words mean anything, inalienable rights cannot be alienated. Second, if government is merely the right of self-defense externalized, are men under any moral obligation to delegate their rights to the state, to the government? How did this moral obligation arise? Unlike Plato and Aristotle, who taught that the state is prior to the individual, Rand taught that the individual is prior to the state. The priority may not be temporal, but it is logical and moral. Why, then, should individuals surrender their rights to an external agency? The answer Rand gave appeared to be because men are evil. She says, such, in essence, is the proper purpose of a government, to make social existence possible to men by protecting the benefits and combating the evils which men can cause to one another. Lest the argument be misunderstood at this point, the question is not whether all or some men commit specific evil actions, for Rand was quite willing to admit that some men do and thereby deserve to be called evil men. The question is whether all men are ethically evil by nature, whether there is a 100% chance of a man thinking and doing evil. It is this idea of sin that Rand castigated as a monstrous absurdity. For Rand, as for the Enlightenment thinkers, nature was normative. To hold man's nature as his sin is a mockery of nature, she wrote. We must conclude then that Rand believed man to be naturally good, and she said so. Now, these two beliefs, namely that government is necessary and that man is naturally good, are in conflict. It is not a question of whether men will perform evil acts. That's, Rand has admitted that they will. The problem is more profound. She wrote, "The possibility of human immorality is not the only objection to anarchy." She objected to anarchy. "Even a society whose every member were fully rational and faultlessly moral could not function in a state of anarchy. It is the need of objective laws and of an arbiter for honest disagreements among men that necessitates the establishment of a government." Now let's look at that statement very carefully. The first point to be noted is that Rand put a great emphasis on need, as though need justifies doing whatever is allegedly needed. This is obviously at odds with her many denunciations of the concept of need as having any value in ethical theory. Need is also the morally loaded word that allows her to slip unnoticed from the realm of the is to the realm of the ought, from the indicative to the imperative mood. But the alleged fact that men need, in some sense, government does not and cannot logically entail the conclusion that government is, on the basis of that need, logically or morally justified. Need is a vague, ambiguous, and morally loaded term that Rand used to play her philosophic tricks in both ethics and politics. In ethics, it is man's alleged need of a moral code that Rand used to justify her desire or her moral theory. In politics, it is man's alleged need of a government that Rand used to try to justify her theory of government. In neither case is her argument logical. The next question that comes up is, how can fully rational and faultlessly moral men disagree? The question arises because a fully rational man will draw the proper conclusions from the knowledge available to him. After all, he is fully rational. And these conclusions will necessarily be consistent with those of every other fully rational man who happens to possess more or less information. Rand wrote from her introduction to Objectivist Epistemology, if fully rational man's grasp is non-contradictory, then even if the scope of his knowledge is modest and the content of his concepts is primitive, it will not contradict the content of the same concepts in the mind of the most advanced scientist. Honest disagreements, this implies the statement that honest disagreements and fully rational men are mutually exclusive concepts. Rand's argument contains another illustration of the fallacy of the stolen concept. This is a fallacy she talks about at great length. The concept honest disagreement presupposes men who are not fully rational. The concept dishonest disagreement presupposes men who are not fully moral. Because of these reasons, objectivism logically leads to anarchy, not limited government in a free society, but to anarchy, because no sovereign individual, and we're all sovereign, aren't we, may be forced to delegate his rights to government. The sovereign individual has every right to refuse to pay taxes, ignore subpoenas, ignore courts of law, resist arrest, and take all measures necessary for the preservation of his rights, including, one supposes, since government is entirely derivative, issuing his own subpoenas, forming his own army, establishing his own courts and judicial procedures, and punishing people. Rand, however, vociferously maintained that she did not advocate an anarchic society. Anarchy is where the doctrine of the inalienable rights of man must logically lead. Rand drew back from this conclusion only by contradicting herself. She could not logically advocate a free society simply because she rejected the Christian axiom of revelation. It is only on the basis of Scripture that one may advocate a free society without self-contradiction, because one does not have to choose between the priority of the government, totalitarianism, or the priority of the individual, anarchy. All secular political philosophy has been based on one or the other of these two premises, and the veerings of history are testimony to the inherently unstable nature of institutions established on these principles. Christianity, the propositions written in the Bible as we've defined it, and Christianity alone furnishes the only logical foundation for a free and stable society. Neither the individual nor the collective is sovereign. God and God alone possesses the attribute of sovereignty. God is prior. Both man and government are derivative. Man is a creature of God. Government is an ordinance of God. It is limited by his law, not by any inherently contradictory notion of human rights. The notion of innate and inalienable rights does not appear in the Bible. Rather than rights, it is God's law that limits governments. Nature is not normative, the Word of God is. Christ's command, the Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's, should be regarded as the Magna Carta of liberty, for it clearly denied, in opposition to all secular philosophy, that Caesar is God, and Caesar's powers are limited, in fact, limited by God. Jesus Christ, not the fascist Aristotle, was America's first founding father. Rand believed that man makes himself, that man must be man by choice, she says. This is a metaphysical statement. By an act of his will, a being can choose to become human. By an act of his will, a man can choose to become subhuman. Accepting Aristotle's definition of man as the rational animal, Rand believed quite literally that man is an animal that can choose to be or not to be human. A man who initiates force, who seeks to live not by producing, but by stealing or looting, has publicly declared his decision to be subhuman, and he thereby becomes subhuman. It is by this means that Rand sought to achieve a reconciliation between the logically contradictory ideas of inalienable rights and self-defense and the logically incompatible ideas of inalienable rights and punishment. On the basis of inalienable rights, self-defense and punishment of criminals would be forbidden, for if rights are by nature inalienable, nothing a person can do can alienate his rights, and therefore any force used against him is a violation of his rights. If man possesses rights by virtue of the fact that he is a man, that is, he possesses rights by nature, then he possesses those rights at all times and in all circumstances. Rand solved the problem here, just as John Locke did. She eliminated inalienable rights by eliminating human nature. Both Rand and Locke posit a metaphysical consequence of an act of the will. In his second treatise of government, John Locke wrote, "Every man in the state of nature has a power to kill a murderer, to secure men from the attempts of a criminal who, having renounced reason, hath by the unjust violence and slaughter he hath committed upon one, declared war against all mankind, and therefore may be destroyed as a lion or a tiger, one of those wild, savage beasts." Locke and Rand both believe that an aggressor may be destroyed because an aggressor quite literally is not human. Since reason is the defining characteristic of man in their thinking, a being who is not acting with reason is not human. The rights of man may be inalienable, according to Rand, but the mannishness of man is not. By choosing not to think, by renouncing reason, by initiating force, a person forfeits his status as a human being. A man cannot lose his rights, but he can lose his humanity. Once one has accepted the Aristotelian definition of man as a rational animal, as Rand did, and also the notion of man as a being of volitional consciousness, this doctrine of forfeiting his humanity follows. The implications of the doctrine of forfeiture is that some beings who look like men, who are descended from men, are not men, for man's differentia is metaphysical. Abortion, for example, becomes moral, for the abortionist is not initiating force against a human being. Since a human being is by definition a being who has chosen to think conceptually, an unborn child is not a human being. Rand wrote, quote, "An embryo has no rights," and she puts it in emphasis, in italics. "Rights do not pertain to a potential, but only to an actual being," unquote. She obviously used some sort of Aristotelian theory of potentiality and actuality in her defense of abortion. But neither Aristotle nor Rand told us what the terms mean. Aristotle furnished illustrations, but no non-circular definition, and Rand did not even try to explain. But more to the present point, Rand presented no argument for her assertion that rights do not pertain to potentials. She simply made the statement. This leads her to some further difficulties. For example, she says, a child cannot acquire rights until it is born. Unquote. That would imply that children, that is, all of us, at some point in time, acquire our rights. That seems to imply that since our rights are acquired, we do not possess our rights by nature, unless, of course, we also acquire a nature. Rights may be inalienable, but natures are not. Rand's view seems to imply that the process by which one acquires rights is locomotion, specifically moving from the womb to the crib. One acquires inalienable rights in Rand's philosophy by changing location. In the same passage, Rand announced that abortion is, quote, a moral right, which should be left to the sole discretion of the woman involved, unquote. Nowhere, to my knowledge, did Rand make similar statements about other medical procedures being moral rights. For some reason, she seemed to have a great deal of emotion invested in the question of abortion. Furthermore, she asserted that abortion is to be left to the sole discretion of the woman. That clearly implies that her husband has no moral rights in the matter, and therefore should have no legal rights. That her parents, if she is a minor, have no moral rights, and obviously the government, which is charged with the purpose of defending individual rights, has no role either. While Rand usually denounced whims and wishes elsewhere, on the question of abortion, quote, nothing other than her wish is to be considered, unquote. In abortion, the woman's wish reigns supreme. Finally, Rand asked, who can conceivably have the right to dictate to her what disposition she is to make of the functions of her own body? But that is a different and an irrelevant question. It is irrelevant unless we are to understand that the unborn child's body is actually the woman's body, in which case the woman has two brains, heads, and hearts, four eyes, ears, arms, and legs, and may be both male or female, or unless we are to understand that the child is a function of the woman's body, analogous to respiration or reproduction. But even the most obtuse abortionist, and Rand isn't obtuse, would not confuse carbon dioxide with the bodily function of respiration, nor babies with the bodily function of reproduction. In other places, Rand referred to the idea that an embryo has a right to life as vicious nonsense and unspeakable. A piece of protoplasm, she wrote, has no rights. And note the next phrase, and no life, in the human sense of the term. Elsewhere, she wrote, a proper, philosophically valid definition of man as a rational animal would not permit anyone to ascribe the status of person to a few human cells. Yet, in Philosophy, Who Needs It?, another of her books, Rand wrote, observe that the egalitarian's view of man is literally the view of a children's fairy tale. The notion that man before birth is some sort of indeterminate thing, an entity without identity, something like a shapeless chunk of human clay. Apparently, her view of abortion is a children's fairy tale. Rand did not draw back from some of the logical consequences of her view of man. She vigorously supported the elimination of laws regulating or outlawing abortion, a position quite consistent with her doctrine of man. But there are further implications of the view. Not only are unborn children not human, born children are not human either. Aristotle in the Politics wrote, and I quote from Aristotle, there should certainly be a law to prevent the rearing of deformed children. The proper thing to do is to limit the size of each family And if the children then conceived in excess of the limit so fixed, to have miscarriage induced before sense and life have begun in the embryo. Aristotle apparently did not realize that a human being lives from conception, and thus he had an excuse which Rand did not have. When Harry Binswanger was editing the Ayn Rand lexicon, he reports, quote, "Miss Rand became increasingly enthusiastic about the project. One value of the book had special meaning to her. It eliminates any shred of excuse for the continual gross misrepresentation of her philosophy at the hands of hostile commentators. As she quipped to me, people will be able to look up breakfast and see that I did not advocate eating babies for breakfast." Unquote. Considering Rand's views on abortion, one wonders why Miss Rand might have objected to eating babies for breakfast. Simply discarding their bodies seems a waste of good, tender, and possibly quite tasty meat. And if they are indeed not human beings, as Rand so vociferously insisted, why not offer the meat for sale, or at least sell their bodies for medical parts or keep them alive for scientific research? What possible moral objection, consistent with her views on abortion and the rights of the mother, could Rand have to such things? Since infants as well as unborn children are not human by Rand's definition, they too are only potentially human, not actually human, there can logically be no immorality in infanticide. To my knowledge, Rand did not publicly endorse infanticide, but infanticide is a logical consequence of her Aristotelian views, and Aristotle explicitly advocated it. If Rand did not, she was inconsistent with her own definitions. For the same reason, Rand's philosophy leads logically to the approval of other types of murder. Because men make themselves, some men are better made than others who are rather shoddy merchandise. Some are not men at all. Logically, then, objectivists, is what her followers are called, objectivists must approve the liquidation of imbeciles, morons, idiots, the retarded, the mediocre who don't think, the men who do not choose to think but survive by imitating and repeating like trained animals, and this is a quotation from Rand, the routine of sounds and motions they learn from others, never making an effort to understand their own work, mental parasites, until the small group known as objectivist is all that's left alive. By that time, however, Rand's following will have increased greatly as people seek to prove their humanity to an objectivist government. Where Christians would fit in among these subhuman animals is debatable. For two reasons. Christians are obviously mystics, whim-worshipping mystics, that is, people who choose not to think, and are therefore subhuman, and Christianity is a type of extortion and fraud. As such, it ought to be outlawed in a free atheist society. One's hopes are not encouraged by Leonard Peikoff, who is Rand's literary heir. Now, Leonard Peikoff's ascribing to Christianity partial responsibility for Nazism. Peikoff wrote, and by the way, there was a big article about Ayn Rand and Leonard Peikoff in U.S. News and World Report about 2 months ago. And if you get the magazine, perhaps you saw the article. Peikoff wrote in his book On the Road Leading from the Ancient World to the Ethics of Nazism, the first major landmark is the development of Christianity. But Christianity is merely the necessary condition of all that followed. By itself, it could not and did not lead to Nazism. Kant could. Speaking of Immanuel Kant, the German philosopher, his ethics is the second and towering landmark on the road. Peikoff, like Rand, a secular Jew, does not think it important or necessary to demonstrate his accusation against Christianity. Nor does he find Aristotle and his totalitarianism a factor in the rise of the pagan Nazi movement. Peikoff is so obtuse he cannot see the logical implications of his own political philosophy. Peikoff's intellectual history is about as accurate as Marianne Schur's political and cultural history. Now, Marianne Schur has published an article about Greek sculpture and Greek Society in 1969, in which she wrote, "Ancient Greece tore away the heavy shroud of mysticism woven for centuries in murky temples, and achieved in 3 centuries what Egypt had not dreamed of in 30, a civilization that was essentially pro-man and pro-life. The achievements of the Greeks rested on their confidence in the power of man's mind, the power of reason. The Greeks built temples for their gods, but they conceived of their gods as perfect human beings." Hardly. Schur's and Rand's and the general public's romantic notions of ancient Greece bear little resemblance to what we know of that civilization. The Greek and Roman gods and goddesses were men and women larger than life. They fought, they schemed, they lied, they got drunk, they raped, they committed incest, they gambled, they stole, they murdered, and so on, hardly perfect human beings. As far as being pro-man and pro-life, the Greek city-states were founded on slavery, practiced infanticide and euthanasia, encouraged suicide, and were continually at war. The historian Oswin Murray tells us of Athens, and I quote here, "For most of the time which Plato describes, Athens was fighting a long and bloody war in which at least half the population died. Many of them from a particularly horrifying plague, which scarred even those who survived it, and which was partly the consequence of the unsanitary conditions in which vast numbers of citizens were camped on every available space of open or sacred land within the city walls. Greece and Rome were built on slave labor. Their philosophers defended slavery. Aristotle, for example, believed that reason was not present in slaves, was inoperative in females, and was undeveloped in children. He recommended abortion and infanticide to be enforced by the rulers if needed to control population growth. He favored and Greece practiced euthanasia. Far from being pro-man and pro-life, the Greek city-states were totalitarian church states. One further consideration on the matter of rights is necessary. Permit me to put before you again Rand's attempted derivation of the concept of inalienable rights. This is what she wrote again. I'm going to take it in a different direction this time. Rights are conditions of existence required by man's nature for his proper survival. If man is to live on earth, it is right for him to use his mind. It is right to act on his own free judgment. It is right to work for his values and to keep the product of his work. If life on earth is his purpose, he has a right to live. Now, this equivocation is supposed to be an argument for establishing man's rights as an intelligible concept. I've already commented on that. What I haven't yet pointed out is that the same argument may be applied to non-human animals. Their purpose is obviously to live on earth. To do so, they must use whatever rudimentary minds they have. They too must act on their own judgments, which they may believe to be as free as we believe our judgments to be. They too must work for their values and retain the product of their work. Since life on earth is the purpose of non-human animals, they too have a right to live. The advocates of the rights of only rational animals may reject this argument for the rights of all animals, including men, yet they will lack logic in their rejection, for Rand's derivation of rights applies equally to all animals, rational or otherwise. Indeed, it might even be argued that Rand's rights argument establishes rights for plants, such as Rand, which, as Rand herself wrote, have values. They obviously live on earth. They work for their values and they keep them. Unfortunately, plants do not have minds or make judgments, although some recent authors might dispute this. But this does not impair the validity of the argument. Plants live. Their existence is not unconditional like stones. They have values. They have an automatic morality. and therefore they have a right to live. Rand herself pointed out on the physical level the functions of all living organisms, from the simplest to the most complex, from the nutritive function in the single cell of an amoeba to the blood circulation in the body of a man, are actions generated by the organism itself and directed to a single goal, the maintenance of the organism's life. Cells, bacteria, viruses, and human embryos, because they are living entities, have goals and values. They live on Earth, work for their values, and keep them. They may not have minds, but their existence is not unconditional. They have values and an automatic code of morality. What furthers their lives is good, what thwarts their lives is evil. It is therefore immoral for anyone to violate their rights to seek to kill them. Objectivist political philosophy logically implies two doctrines, a pantheistic reverence for life and a totalitarian survival of the most human. I must conclude then that Rand failed to present either a coherent ethical theory or a logically consistent political theory. Her political theory, like all secular political theories, leads logically to anarchy and/or totalitarianism. It cannot furnish the basis for a free society, despite the brilliant rhetoric that seeks to persuade in lieu of logic. Its acceptance by a large segment of the American citizenry will hasten the future of the boot stamping on the human face forever. Furthermore, her express advocacy of a free society ought to be disregarded for a reason that one of her own disciples stated, and I quote, "A philosopher's political views, to the extent that they contradict the essentials of his system, have comparatively little historical significance." Unquote. The apologetic task is complete. Rand's philosophy is in ruins, and any hope of resurrecting it is wishful thinking. It has been shown to be self-contradictory and in conflict with Scripture. It's our job as Christian apologists to do the same with all arguments that set themselves up against the knowledge of God. Now, any comments or questions about this? About Rand's philosophy or Thomas Jefferson's philosophy? Going after Rand, I sort of swiped Jefferson there. Yes, sir.
In your book, the last chapter, you have a section where you criticize the view that science discovers truth, and the argument given to that often is that we know it's true because it works so well. A pragmatic argument.
Mm-hmm.
And you show how that's an invalid argument. But then on the next page, when you're talking about presuppositions, say that presuppositions can never be proven, they can only be disproven. It seems like you might be in the same situation. The scientist has his hypotheses that he can never prove, he can only disprove them. But then you've got the presuppositions that you can never prove, you can only disprove them. How would you get out of that bind?
By saying I'm not presenting an argument for the truth of the presuppositions. I'm making plain, or at least I'm attempting to make plain, the implications of Rand's assumptions and the implications of Christian assumptions so that people understand exactly what each package entails. If they see, for example, that Rand's view of inalienable rights logically entails no punishment, no justice, and it also entails no protection for unborn children, or no protection for born children, for that matter, then they will have a better way of judging the value of those presuppositions. If they see, on the other hand, that making Christian presuppositions results in a civilized society, then they will have a better idea of what the package called Christianity implies. but I'm not attempting to prove the presuppositions, and I hope I'm not falling into the same area of making a logical fallacy here that the scientists do. With science, in fact, it's even more complicated, much more complicated than I said in the book there, because it turns out the scientists can not only not prove their theories, they can't disprove them either. And it becomes very complicated in the case of science. They can't rule out theories in the scientific method. What we're doing here, what I'm attempting to do, and I do it in some of the appendices to the book there, is to make things a little bit clearer, is to give people as clear a picture as possible, clear an idea as possible, of what each philosophy means. How does this work out in society? How does it work out in government? How does it work out in ethics? And as they understand with the implications of each philosophy, then they will be better able to choose the first principle, knowing what they're choosing, rather than what Rand's rhetoric might lead them to choose. And she's a very, very good writer, at least in her novels. Her novels are very well constructed. And in her novels, she brings all sorts of persuasive factors into play, in addition to logic, and people are swayed by that. Yes, sir.
Just touch briefly on something about that science can't disprove their theories, so they can't, some induction can't check out anything in the pool to see that it's not there.
Well, that's true. It can't. But in any scientific experiment, there's always more than one factor involved. And you cannot construct an experiment so that you're only testing one thing at a time. Now, scientists will say they attempt to do that, and they try to do that, but they do it only within the framework of a theory, an entire theory. And maybe that entire theory is wrong, rather than a specific theory as it applies to this experiment. That's what makes it very difficult. Go ahead.
Well, I'm confused a little bit. I thought I understood it at first, but her view of right, if I understood you right, that her theory of right would apply to rational or irrational beings.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yes. She applied it only to rational animals, human beings.
Okay. So they're the only ones who deserve to have rights, rational.
That's what she says. Yeah. My argument is that her argument, if you look at her argument for why men have rights, the argument applies just as well to dogs. Dogs, she says, the difference between a living being, a being with values, a being with a need for an ethical system, is the fact that its existence is not unconditional. A stone's existence is unconditional. You have an inanimate and inorganic stone. Its existence is unconditional, she says. But I can go out of existence. I can die. So I need an ethical system. And I need rights to protect my life. Well, that whole argument that applies to human beings will also apply to dogs. A dog can die. A dog's existence can stop. So he needs values. He needs dog food. He needs water, whatever. And those are his values, and he seeks his values. The dog seeks his values.
So has she redefined what rational is then?
No, she just said the rights, I don't think she ever thought of it. She just said the rights apply only to human beings. And I don't think she ever thought of the idea that the argument, as she constructed it, would apply to dogs as well. Mm-hmm. But you have, you know, within the past 20 or 30 years, the animal rights movement. And some of the influence for that came out of the objectivist movement, this whole animal rights movement. And back in the 70s, someone even wrote a book, and that was what my allusion to plants meant. Someone wrote a book about plants. You know, they used to tell you to talk to your plants and do stuff like this because the plants understood and it soothed them or whatever, helped their self-esteem. And
you know, there's something there in plants that we don't know about. Well, I'm sure there's lots about plants we don't know about, but the idea was they have souls or spirits or something of that sort, and they benefit from conversation. And if that's the case, or even if it's not the case, their existence can end. Plants can die. They need food. They need water, just like dogs do. So they have an ethical system too, and they have rights.
Would she openly support euthanasia based on the older people's living rationality?
Not to my knowledge. I don't recall offhand reading anything she wrote on euthanasia. She was openly and very loudly a supporter of abortion, but I don't recall reading anything on euthanasia. Yeah, it is definitely an implication. But when you're an elderly lady, you don't want to write about such things. Speaking of euthanasia, I had the opportunity to hear a professor at a state university in Tennessee recently put forth his views that some people have a duty to die. And a moral duty to die, and he was debating Nat Hentoff, the columnist who rejected the idea. But he began his lecture, the professor did, who put forth this view that people have a duty to die. He began his lecture by saying that I definitely am not one of them, but some of these people have a duty to die.
Some people have a duty to die, then does it follow from that that other people have a right to take their life?
Well, he would probably say that. I'm not sure that it does follow from that, but he would argue that some people, because there are drains on the federal budget, have a duty to die. And that line of thinking is exactly how the Nazis executed people by the millions in Germany. In the 1920s, the 1930s, even before Hitler came to power, the German physicians had accepted the idea that some people had a duty to die. They had coined the phrase life unworthy of living. And because it became a drain on the government's treasury, yes, we can euthanize them. Because they're consuming resources that could be better used for young, healthy people. Now, we don't need to keep old people alive when we could be building new schools. And when you have the government involved in such matters, that's the sort of argument you're going to see.
Making an abortion.
He's the only doctor who still makes house calls. Don't knock him. Yes, sir.
Why do you suppose you were the only Christian writer who responded at least to Ayn Rand? In particular, why don't you think any of the evidentialist apologies try to answer for anyone?
I don't know. I don't know. They would have an epistemology in common with Rand. But I really don't know. Whether they haven't taken her seriously or what. She certainly has an influence among college students. One would think that somebody like Josh McDowell would have taken her on years ago. But to my knowledge, there is no other critique out there of her philosophy from a Christian point of view.
Who do they spend their time taking on?
Well, who do they write against? I don't know.
Presuppositionalists.
Me, yeah. No, I really don't know, Dan. That's a good question. They have so much in common with the unbelievers that it's difficult to know. They will take on science up to a point, you know, because they don't like the atheism of the scientists. But they agree with much of science, but they want to take the body that they agree with, the body of teaching they agree with, and say, well, this does logically show that there is a creator or a designer or something of that sort. Yeah. But there's no thoroughgoing critique of science or of Ayn Rand, to my knowledge. Any other questions or comments? Yes, sir. Back to Tom.
In your book, you showed several places how similar Rand's views are to the 19th century materialists.
Yes.
Especially Engels. Why do you suppose Rand seemed to keep it such a secret that she had used some of it in?
Well, Rand, you have to keep in mind, was educated under the Soviets. She was born in 1905 when that's Tsarist Russia. But then the revolution happens in 1917, and by coincidence, that's the same year she decides she's an atheist, 1917, when she's 12 years old. Then she continues her education in the Soviet Union, graduates from, I think it was the University of originally St. Petersburg and then Leningrad, about 1924, and takes honors in philosophy. She studied philosophy there, and then escapes to the United States. And she says at some point in her writing that she regards the liberals in the U.S. as the exemplars of reason. She has nothing but scorn and disdain for conservatives. She says they base their defense of a free society on mysticism, on revelation, and on whim worshiping and other things of that nature. And she wants to appeal to the liberals, who she sees as rational, as reasonable men, primarily because they're atheists. And she says that's what we have to offer, is a rational, what she called a rational defense of a free society. I don't know if she went out of her way to hide her sympathy with the communist epistemology and metaphysics.
Yeah, she's got that line in one of her books where she says, "No, my only philosophical
That's true.
Debt is to Aristotle."
That's true. That's true. You're right. She says, "My only debt is to Aristotle." And she denounces the communists as mystics. She wants to place them very much in the same camp as Christians. We're all mystics. They're muscle mystics. We're spiritual mystics or something. I've forgotten what she's called us. So in that sense, she does try to obscure, anyway, her debt to the Marxists.
Do you know if she ever had any conversations with Mises or Karn?
Yes, yes. And she and Mises were not only acquaintances, I'm told, but good friends. Mises is the Austrian economist, free market economist, who came to the U.S. prior to World War II to escape Hitler. And there's one funny story about Rand and Mises. Someone was looking for a person to take on a particular task, and they asked Mises who he would recommend, and his response was, "Well, you need to get Ayn Rand. She's the right man for the job." And she said, later she heard this story, and she says, "Did he say man?" And they says, "Yes, he said man." She says, "Great." She thought that was a high compliment coming from Mises. She's the right man for the job.
Well, on the contemporary political scene in philosophy or whatever, raising questions about unalienable rights.
There was a gentleman who wrote a book about 20 years ago called Robert Andelson. And he titled his book Imputed Rights. I don't know if the book is still in print. It's a very slim book. And the title is excellent. The title is excellent. I think the title captures the Christian view of rights. It's not our inalienable or our natural rights that limit government, but God's law. It's not that we so much that we have a right to life, but that God has said, you shall not murder. And the rights that you might say we enjoy are imputed rights. They're not inherent, they're not infused, they're not innate, they're imputed rights. They're imputed by the law of God. And Andelson, in that book, criticized the idea of inalienable rights. I don't know, well, liberals have too, people like Rawls at Harvard, the political philosopher. But generally speaking, at least the rhetoric of rights is so pervasive that you find it throughout the conservative movement and throughout the libertarian movement, and in fact much of the liberal movement itself, the liberal or socialist movement, everybody has rights. You look at the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. You know, you got rights to everything there. And once you start down that road, you know, there's no stopping point as to what rights we have. I don't know, to answer your question. Any other comments or questions? This is one reason, I think, why Christian political theory is so important. Because the secular political theory, even when it comes from conservatives or people that you might otherwise agree with on some specific issues, in the end undermines a free society.
Should the apologists be the primary ones to work out political theory? Or should there be people that are primarily, you know, take that on, that don't, you know, I'm trying to figure out if that.
Sure, sure. There's room for a division of labor. There's far more work to be done than any single person can do, and we need political philosophers. We need ethical philosophers. We need right philosophers of science.
Branches of philosophy. I'm trying to figure out philosophy is a branch of political.
Well, everything, all these people who specialize do, though, should be geared toward the defense of the faith. Everything they do. Yeah, yeah. You know, if you have a Christian writing about science, what he should be doing is defending the truth of Christianity in his discussions of science and the philosophy of science. Or the same for ethics or aesthetics or whatever. They all have one purpose. But there's so much work to be done. We have to specialize. You got to convince enough people to get involved in the work, though. Any other comments? Well, I thank you very much for your hospitality. It's been a pleasure being here in Rowlett. It's been a pleasure getting to know you folks, and especially the Bacons. And we appreciate your invitation. If you're ever in Upper East Tennessee, please be sure to come see us. We're a little bit more hilly than you are here in Texas. A little bit more green. But we don't have an income tax either, so we do have something in common. Thank you very much. You've been very kind.